Session number 7257.
Mr. Lane, tape two. Mr. Lane, before I go on to more of your experiences in the Western Front, could I just go back to the early period when you were still in England?
Yeah.
Your training. Did you have much gunnery training with your Enfield rifle?
As far as I remember, we never fired a shot. Never fired a shot. But mind you, we'd already done that, you see. I mean, when during the early days, when you joined the Territorials, you first of all had a short range in the drill hall, you see. And then every year you had to take a course of musketry outside up to 500 yards. And I remember I won the recruit's prize for the first year I was in the Territorials. I had very good eyesight, you see, and I got quite a good score. You'd fire from 100, 200, up to 500 yards. But during the actual training in Suffolk, as far as I can remember, we never fired a shot.
When you arrived at the front, how proficient were you? Could you take aim and be fairly accurate?
Oh, yes, we could do that, all right. As I say, we'd already passed I'm not sure about the new recruits because they couldn't possibly have done it. Not as far as I know. I never saw anybody, I never heard anybody having a rifle course at all. Yes, but it didn't matter really. You see, the aiming business was all very well for snipers, but in those days the Germans used to come over in masses. You see. And as long as you could fire rapidly, that was a great thing. But we never had much rifle training at all, really. But you soon got the idea, of course.
How old were you when you
19.
First went?
19. Nearly 20. Mm-hmm.
And what was the date? November, was it?
5th of November when we sailed. Yes, and we landed in France on the early morning of the 6th of November.
It sounds to me, from what you've said, that your morale was quite high in the beginning.
Oh yes, quite high. Oh yes, we didn't know what we were going for, of course. And our morale stayed high too, I must say that. I mean, it was amazing, really. The way the men, even when they realised that we were up against it, you know, we were going to have a very rough time, but they didn't lose their optimism, not at all.
You never found that?
No. One thing that we still thought the Russians were going to. There was a rumor going around that the Russians were only 70 miles from Berlin. You see. That all helped, I suppose.
Mm. Well, I wonder if you'd continue and
yes.
Continue to relate
yes.
your experiences.
Well, we then were ordered to go up to a position just behind the front line. This entailed a march, again along the railway track, and then onto a road which was ankle-deep in slimy mud. And eventually we reached the woodlands where the trenches were. This wood was called non-boschen. Well, I call it non-boschen, I don't know what they call it. And it means nun's wood. It's N-O-N-N-E-B-O-S-C-H-E-N. And in this wood, there were dugouts, and we were all allotted a dugout, two or three men to a dugout. And this was getting on towards evening time, it was dark anyway. We got into these dugouts and got some sleep, but during the night, there would be heavy rifle fire every half hour or so. It would start off with somebody firing a single shot, and then there would be a sudden crescendo of fire going right along the line, and that would stop. We, of course, thought that the Germans were attacking. In fact, of course, they weren't. Well, then, in the morning, we got out of our dugout, had some bully beef and biscuits and water. I don't remember having any tea there at all, anything warm at all. And there was a flurry of snow, I remember. Only it didn't settle, it was just what they call wet snow. Anyway, we got out and we were wondering about these woods, you see. Curious to know what it was all about, you know, where we were. And my particular friend and I, wandered in one direction. And as we were going along, we were still in the wood, we heard a machine gun open fire, an enemy machine gun. And then there were screams. And two or three of our men who were walking down a ride. You know, a ride in a wood where they, every wood has these rides about this distance, I suppose, of clear ground where, you know, for movement. And apparently this ride that these men were walking on was under a direct observation of the enemy. Nobody had told us, and we'd given no warning about this at all. We were allowed to wander around. And I'm not blaming anybody for that, because everybody was in a state of sort of, it was a state of chaos, really. Anyway, my friend and I wandered down in by the side of the ride, but still in the wood, not on the ride, and we certainly wouldn't go on the ride after that incident. We eventually came to a sort of farmhouse, I suppose it would be called. It was still intact, only a small place. And in the yard there was a pig running about squealing, and some Royal Engineers were trying to catch this pig, and they'd already had a go at cutting its throat, but they hadn't completely succeeded, you see. Anyway, they got the pig eventually. We went into the building, and in this building there were two or three regular soldiers, because a regular army, this was all regular army, you see, apart from us territorials. And there were two or three regular soldiers of the 1st King's Liverpool Regiment. And we spoke to these men. One had been wounded in the hand, and he was walking up and down in terrific pain, apparently moaning. And the other one, I don't know why he was there, but he was not obviously wounded at all. And we asked him about the regiment, and he told us they called him Cocky Lord. He was a Cockney, you see. And I asked him how he got into the Liverpool regiment. He said, well, you didn't have much choice. Anyway, he had been out there from the start, quite a few. There were still quite a few people there who had been there from the start, just the Mons, you see. And then a man was brought in, shaking like an aspen leaf, and he was helped in, and he was dumped down in the room, sort of thing, near the wall. And somebody threw an army greatcoat over him. He was shaking all the time. I should think it was exposure, probably. I don't know what it was, but anyway, no, there was no. You realised, of course, that you couldn't be sympathetic. You had to be hard. You see, I mean, there was no point in being sympathetic, because you only made things worse. And we then went back to our dugouts and spent another night there, and the same thing happened, this crescendo of rifle fire every now and again. And also during the night there were sharp rifle fire cracks all in the woods all round us. Well, apparently it was thought that the wood was occupied by snipers, and it was decided to have a sniper drive. So we all spread out in open order and went through the woods. Well, we never found any snipers at all. But we did find a mail bag, a discarded mail bag, which was apparently belonging to the First King's Liverpools. This mail bag was opened, and we had a look inside and found a cake. And we, without any compunction, we took this cake, because we were practically starving, and we ate this cake eventually. It was the wrong thing to do, because the mail bag, we didn't know that the First King's Liverpools were anything to do with us, you see. We got no idea. As I say, we found no snipers, but we were then told that we had been attached to the 4th Guards Brigade in the 2nd Division. And we knew later that the 1st Kings were a battalion of the 2nd Division, the 5th Brigade. Well, eventually after another day or two, we were told we were going into the front line. And it must be understood that there were no trenches in those days, only rifle pits. In each rifle pit would be two or three men. We got to these rifle pits were sited along a cross drive in the woods, one of these drives, you see.
Could I ask you what the difference is between a rifle pit and a trench?
Well, a trench is continuous, you see. A rifle pit has just room for two or three men, then there's a space, and then another rifle pit. A trench, a properly made trench, has traverses. It goes like that.
So it zigzags. Yeah.
That sort of thing, to prevent infrared fire spreading, you see, any fire spreading, you see. But there was no trench there, it was just a rifle pit. And when we got to this ride, the Germans opened heavy fire. They must have heard us. And these bullets, fortunately, were going just above our heads. And you could see what they call tracer bullets. We didn't know what they were, but they were a sort of ember, sort of red, you know. Anyway, we weren't hit. None of us was hit. And we got to, we continued along this ride, and so many men, two or three men were dropped off at each rifle pit, and the men who had been in the rifle pits were the first lifeguards, and they'd been there for several days, I suppose. When we got to the rifle pit that my friend and I were told to occupy, we were told that there was a wounded man inside and that we must get him out and take him along the ride to the end of the ride on a stretcher. Well, we did this, and he was, of course, a big man, being a lifeguard, and we had to step over tree trunks. Quite a few trees had been knocked down by the shellfire, you see. Anyway, we got this job done, and we got into our rifle pit. We still weren't quite sure where the enemy were. We knew they were in front of us, and we knew they weren't all that distance away, but we didn't know how far, and we were still in the woods, you see. Well, neither of us had a watch, and we were supposed to do 2 hours on and 4 hours off, you see. And we were very tired and irritable by that time. And we had arguments about whether we'd done our 2 hours or not. Nobody could tell, really, without a watch. Anyway, we got through the night somehow. And the next morning, there was heavy gunfire on our right flank. That's the right of our battalion. And after a time, a Jantin was thrown into our rifle pit, and my friend happened to be there and caught it. And in it was a message which said that the enemy were attacking or preparing to attack the right flank of the battalion. Well, my friend immediately got out of this rifle pit in broad daylight, this was, and ran down to the battalion headquarters. And he brought a message back which said, stay in your rifle pits and calmly shoot the enemy down. That's all it said. And he passed this tin along so they'd got to the right flank again. And fortunately, do you want to do something? Unfortunately, the enemy did not really attack. Not in full force, anyway. They were simply altering their position, really, advancing their position, but not with the intention of attacking, you see. They were getting on the different ground. And the heavy gunfire was simply a protection for them, you see. But the heavy gunfire did, in fact, cause quite a few casualties amongst our right flank men.
Were you very frightened when you thought there might be an attack? Can you remember how you felt?
No, I can't remember being frightened. Well, we were, I suppose, apprehensive about it, because this gunfire was something that we'd seen on that road before only, you see, and we were 400 or 500 yards away then. But even this time, we were 100 yards away, and it didn't seem to bother you unless the fire was coming straight for you, you see.
Had you plenty of ammunition in your...
We got plenty of rifle fire, but it wasn't a rifle fire that was a trouble, it was a gunfire. The British artillery at that time were completely outgunned by the Germans, not the slightest doubt about that. Most of our guns were 18-pounders, you see. And if they fired over our heads, all it sounded like was a pop, really. But the Germans, they got 5.9s, you see. They were much superior all the time up to 1916 artillery fire. So that we really couldn't do anything about it. But anyway, this gunfire died away eventually. And we continued for another 24 hours in the trenches, in the rifle pits, I should say, without any further incident occurring. And we came back to our dugout position about 300 or 400 yards in the rear. In other words, we were relieved by another battalion of the Guards Brigade. I can't remember who it was. Well, then we went to another position at a place called Zillebeek, Zillebeke, I think it's spelled. And we went into some rifle pits there. Nothing much happened there, not that I can remember. Anyway, this went on for about 3 weeks, I suppose, going from one set of rifle pits to another. And then we were told that we were being relieved by the French army. Well, eventually the night of relief came. And the French soldiers came along there with lanterns alight, chattering like magpies. It was extraordinary, really. The Germans didn't seem to hear it, because they could have heard it, must have heard it. Anyway, the French came along there like that in their sort of sloppy way, really, compared with our formations. And they relieved us, and we marched off. And we were glad to get away, because we thought with all the noise they were making, they'd simply be in for a battering from the German gunners, you see. But they didn't, apparently. God knows why. And we got back to, we marched along a road again, and By this time it was getting quite frosty. And the French roads, of course, were all cobbles, you know, they were all these cobbles. And they were getting quite slippery. We didn't know where we were going, of course, but we knew we were going out of the line. And we marched along fairly happily for a time, but it was getting quite hard work getting along, really. And before we'd gone many miles, men were beginning to fall out. Well, we'd been 2 or 3 weeks without any real sleep. We hadn't had our boots off or anything off for 3 weeks. And we'd had no proper food, really, for 3 weeks. We had nothing hot, anyway. Anyway, we marched along for a few miles, and as I say, men began falling out. And the regimental sergeant major came along with his stick, and he gave them a wallop until they got up and started marching again, because you couldn't possibly leave them there, would have frozen to death, you see. Anyway, we were those of us that were still fairly fit, we marched along, most of us, that was 90% of us, I suppose, for another hour or so, and we saw some fires burning in the distance. And we came to these fires, and what it was a stopping place for us, really. And what they'd done was built up these fires and made huge dishes of tea for us and rum, you see. That was marvellous. This was about the middle of the night, I suppose. Well, we had this tea and rum, and off we went again. And we were marching all night. Well, then we came to, at about dawn, or just after dawn, we came to a hill, quite a steep hill. You've heard of Mount Camel, have you? Well, it was in that area somewhere, and the hill we were going to climb, I always thought it was Mont de Cat, or Car, I don't know how they pronounce it, C-A-T-S, Mont de Car. But I'm not sure about that, mind you. There were several hills like that around there. And we started marching up this hill. Well, by that time, of course, we were all getting very worn out. And we were getting mixed up with Grenadier guards and Irish guards who'd gone on before us. But some of these were the waverers, the stragglers, I should say. And we were sort of catching up with them, you see. We got to the top of this hill, and then we could see a small town down below. And we eventually reached this town, which was called Meteren, M-E-T-E-R-E-N. That was going to be our rest destination for the next 2 or 3, 3 or 4 weeks, I think. When we got to into Meteren, it was a kind of a miner's dream of home, really. The houses right onto the pavement. Very poor place. And we simply flopped down into the road and just lay there waiting to find out where we'd got to go, where we were going to be billeted. Eventually, about 10 of us were going to be billeted in a cottage there. And we went into this cottage. And it was simply bare boards, very crude furniture. A very small place, really. But they got, there was an old gentleman and his wife, and they had two daughters. They were about 20, in their 20s, I suppose. And we went in there, but they had one room, one small room, as big as that one there, I suppose, where we went to sleep, you see. Well, we didn't care that that was like going into Buckingham Palace for us, to get warm. I've never again experienced it. They had one of these long French stoves right in the middle of their living room, you see, and it was really beautifully warm. It was such a sensation of being warm again was wonderful. Never felt anything like it since. Anyway, we got eventually used to that, of course. And we stayed at Metron for about 3 or 4 weeks, I suppose. We didn't do much there. Of course, it was right in December, you see. Well, November, end of November, in December, really. And we did a few exercises, you know, rifle drill and that sort of thing. But we hardly saw an officer. And we simply rested, that was all.
How did you get on with your hosts, the French people?
Oh, we got on all right with them, but we couldn't. I was the only one that could speak any French at all. And our men were fortunately well behaved, and we didn't get any trouble at all with them. After every night, they would give us, they would say, smoking or something like that. And we'd say yes, and we'd have a rum issue. We had quite a lot of rum there, and we'd give the old gent a rum issue, and he was quite happy too. And there was really no trouble at all. Well, of course, we had all our own rations. We didn't take anything from them, no, but they were doing, for, you know, a French peasant, they were doing well. They were getting so much a night for each man, you see.
Were you able to cook your food there?
Oh, no, we never cooked any food on our own, but we did get warm food there because we had a company cook, you see. And they used to bring us round, wasn't anything very much, I can't remember what it was really, but up to that time they were very poor rations, but they were hot. It might have been bully beef warmed up or something of that. Anyway, we were fairly well fed, I think. And we had bread, that was another thing, bread, that was another. We hadn't had any bread, we'd been here, these old, you know, I don't know if you've seen them, like dog biscuits, really. That's all we'd had, you see. And we got hot tea, of course, and that sort of thing. We used to spend our time gambling, playing cards, and that sort of thing. That was all, most of the time.